How do you fight a war called madness?
Well, you know, for that matter, how do you fight a cola war called madness?
I don't know. Drink a ton of Jolt?
No, that's actually a war crime.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Tighten up your straitjackets, laughing loonies. It's time for another scintillatingly psychotic episode of Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that clearly stared far too long at the sun. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, the once and Fisher King, and I am joined by my friend, co-host, and the craziest motherfucker this side of Congress, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. We're here in the... It is a rare, rare thing tonight. We are here in the Casa de la Worm.
The Casa del Worm, and deep in the bowels, in the dungeon, in fact. Why do you have a dungeon, exactly?
You don't need to worry about
it. Yeah, I'm not going to ask that.
Don't worry your pretty little head about it, baby. Ain't none of your concern.
That's something I don't want to know. But what you should know is that we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Junk Food Cinema, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ you guessed it, maniacs, Junk Food Cinema. Well, it had to happen. March is ending, and so too must the madness. But before we break a few necks, bend a few bars, and stroll on out of the asylum, we're throwing one last lunatic soiree. We skip the first eight and leap immediately to the ninth configuration.
Toward the end of the war in Vietnam, an unusually high percentage of American servicemen suddenly manifested symptoms of psychosis. Most of them were in combat, or slated for combat, and had no prior history of mental disturbance.
Oh, the Polanski movie, right?
The Polanski movie, yes. The ninth configuration. I'm pretty sure that's... I don't know what that means. But
that's the ninth gate.
Oh, right.
You know, and I bring that up as a little joke because that is one of the odd confusions that people have when you bring up, oh, man, that movie, The Ninth Configuration. It's like, oh, you mean the Johnny Depp movie by Polanski? And it's like,
No,
that's The Ninth Gate. This is The Ninth Configuration. An oddball, obscure, wonderful little gem from 1980 that is just one of those films that is just so weird that it's hard to believe it exists.
Exactly. And it's funny to me, this is probably one of the more obscure movies we've ever talked about. Like, this is a movie that, despite its amazing cast, despite who the director is, a lot of people that I had talked to about this had no idea it existed. But I will give credit to the one person who's... I'm going to give them credit without remembering what their name is. I'm sorry. Somebody on Facebook actually guessed what we were doing this week. Just from us, literally all we said was it was a really, really obscure movie. And they were like...
That you probably have never heard of. Maybe like three of you have.
And he was like, is it The Ninth Configuration? I'm like, how is that your first guess? I am very impressed. So go you, listener.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, there's not really a ton of movies about insanity. Particularly a ton of great ones about insanity.
True.
If you've seen this, you remember this one. I mean, this is one that... it's really one of those word of mouth movies. You know, invariably a friend hands you a copy because it's rarely in print. And I remember, it was Chris Cox, your partner in crime over at One of Us.
Yep.
Who, 10 years ago handed me a copy of this and said, dude, you've never seen The Ninth Configuration. Watch this now. And so when you mentioned it as one of the choices, I was like, oh, hell yes. I'm due a rewatch for that. It's a really interesting, weird fucking little film.
Absolutely. And I want to preface this right now by saying, guys, like, there are a lot of reasons why you might not have seen this movie. Just think it's in terms of production and in terms of what happened after production. And we'll touch on those as we go along. But if you haven't seen this movie, by all means, don't feel bad. I would be shocked, like I was shocked when the one person guessed what it was, if you even heard of this movie. But basically, the plot revolves around this military asylum in the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., it caters to crazy and AWOL soldiers. Now, at the beginning of the film, we have not only a new inmate, but a new commanding officer. And the new inmate is a former astronaut who has a complete mental breakdown during a launch and refuses to go to the moon. Like, just will not go to the moon, and they end up committing him. And about the same time, into the asylum comes their new commanding officer, their new overseer, played by the great Stacy Keach.
Well, and you forgot, you mentioned Stacy Keach, but you've got to mention that the astronaut is played by Scott Wilson.
This is true.
Who, most of you will hear that name and be like, Scott Wilson, isn't that the kid that grew up around the block from me? No, this is, you want to talk about most generic actor names in the world, his name is Scott Wilson. Most of you will know him from The Walking Dead seasons 2 through 4 as Herschel. You know, the old man veterinarian who is the father to several of the principal characters in the cast. And the when I was watching this, it was one of those movies I had to turn off half an hour in because I'm like, why do I know this guy? This guy is clearly younger. I know him.
It was driving you mad.
It was, because I'm like, I know his cadence. I know his voice. I know his face. Why can I? And then, of course, it's like, oh, yeah, it's Scott Wilson. And then, of course, when you look him up, you're like, I've seen this guy in a dozen different movies. He's just one of those hardworking genre actors who's been doing stuff consistently, and this is probably his meatiest and best role.
And I'm glad you bring up character actors, because this film is chock full of them in various size roles. I mean, just off the top of my head, I mean, we mentioned Stacy Keach, we mentioned Scott Wilson, Jason Miller, who you may remember as Father Karras from The Exorcist, Neville Brand is in this, Robert Loggia, Tom Atkins, Joe Spinell. I mean, the list is remarkable. Richard Lynch, who was the bad guy in Bad Dreams and a number of other...
Oh, well, Richard Lynch, for those of you JFC hardcores out there, you have probably seen about a dozen movies starring Richard Lynch. And when he shows up, it's one of those giddy little moments where it's like, ah, it's Richard Lynch. He's the bad guy in this and this and this and this. And you will rattle off a million.
And in this.
And in this. Well, I mean... I'm not gonna rattle off his entire career because it's kind of fucking big. Like, if you watch genre films in the 70s and 80s, you know exactly who Richard Lynch is. Even if you don't recognize the name, you'll see him and you'll be, that's the bad guy from Sword and the Sorcerer or whatever movie you key in on that he's from. Cause he's great. He's actually, it's odd. He's cast in a very weird role. It's a very small role. Mm-hmm. And he, unlike every other movie known to man, is actually overshadowed by the character actor playing opposite him.
That is true. But we'll get to that. Cause that scene that he's in, that brief scene in this movie, is probably the most memorable of the whole film. I mean, people talk about that scene above all, but we'll get there in just a moment.
Let me also tell you one of the other main reasons why this film is so fucking interesting.
Why is this film so fucking interesting,
Hugo? It technically exists in the same universe as The Exorcist. Reagan speaks of an aborted moon launch, and that's this moon launch. And what she's talking about is this astronaut in this movie. So when we get to the ending of this film, everything about this film completely ties into The Exorcist as if it were a weird fucking sideways sequel.
See, and it's funny because you keyed into that connection and I keyed into another one that will unite these two movies. And it isn't just the fact that Jason Miller's in it, but we will get to that momentarily. I want to talk for just a second about Stacy Keach's performance in this film. He is ridiculously intense, but what I like about it is it's a very understated type of intense. He packs so much complicated rage and neuroses into the quietest performance you've ever seen. And I love what he does with this role. I mean, Stacy Keach is kind of one of my favorite actors anyway, but I think this is one of those like top tier career defining performances for him.
Oh, absolutely. No, he's super great. And there's so many quiet moments for him. And there's a very weird element to the production of this film that you can't quite tell while you're watching it if it's intentional or accidental. Mm-hmm. But so much of what's going on in the background is done through ADR and is laid over Stacy Keach's scenes. So you're not sure throughout the film whether these are things that are actually going on around him or whether this is shit that's going on inside of his head while he's staring off out the window. And it makes for a very weird, very unsettling narrative, because you're just, it's not like a film where, like what we talked about a few weeks ago with 12 Monkeys, where you're not sure what's real and what's not because of the plot. You're not sure what's real and what's not because you don't know if it's just bad ADR or whether it really is supposed to be in his head or not. So it's either a filmmaking, you know, a weak filmmaking or strong filmmaking. And it's like, which is it? I don't fucking know. But you know what? It really works. And really, especially when you rewatch this movie, knowing its ending, really creates a very interesting version of the narrative.
And the other obvious Exorcist connection here is that The Exorcist, while directed by William Friedkin, is based on a book written by William Peter Blatty.
And a screenplay.
And a screenplay by Blatty. This movie, Ninth Configuration, was written and directed. This is the directorial debut of William Peter Blatty.
And what is the only other film he wrote and directed?
It was called, it has some religious sounding name.
Exorcist 3?
Oh, was it Exorcist 3?
It was Exorcist 3. Oh. The only other good Exorcist movie.
That's true. That is actually very true. Now, Ninth Configuration may seem like an odd first directorial effort from the writer of The Exorcist, because it does, for all of its intensity, it is a comedy. It's a dark comedy that has some really dramatic elements to it. And
that's story, its intention, at the very least.
The story driving it is actually very dramatic. But overall, I mean, the trappings of this movie, it's a comedy. And you sit there, and if all you know of William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist, you sit there going, how the fuck did he make a comedy? Turns out his background is in comedy. He began as a comedy writer. The guy wrote A Shot in the Dark for laughing out loud. Like, that's how he got his start. He was doing comedy. In fact,
yeah.
His career got launched by the Groucho Marx show. He went on there to promote a book. He dressed as a sheik. It was this whole bit. I can't remember the name of the show now. What's My Line, I think it was. Yeah. So he goes on What's My Line. He wins $10,000, and he uses that money to quit his day job and become a writer full time. Groucho Marx literally is the reason that he had a career in the first place. But once he wrote The Exorcist, he became so pigeonholed as a horror guy that people kind of lost sight of that. In fact, one of the problems that Blatty had with one of the cuts of this, or the way this movie was marketed, is that one of the studios, when they made the radio spots for the movie, cut it with like extra chains and screams and haunted house noises and tried to make it sound like The Exorcist. And he was so mad that it was Warner Brothers. He actually pulled the movie from Warner Brothers. He's like, no, you can't have this anymore because you clearly don't understand what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's weird because it's the first hour of it is supposed to be very much be a comedy. And it's humorous and there's some interesting funny moments, but the comedy doesn't really work. It's not zany. And it's not just dark comedy. It's, you know, it's a bunch of people who are insane. And there's a few laugh out loud moments, but you're not sure how serious it's supposed to be taken. In fact, it was funny because I watched it with my wife and then we were talking about it later today. And I said, the weird thing is it's supposed to be a comedy. She's like, that was supposed to be a comedy? Because it really doesn't work like one. If you sit down watching this as a comedy, you are not going to connect with it. Because while there are some good jokes, there are some good bits. The movie is heavy right from the get-go. It's surreal. I mean, for fuck's sake, it opens up with all of these prolonged, slow shots of this castle in the rain, in the fog, and one of the characters staring out the window while an old 70s song about missing old San Antone.
A song we're actually quite familiar with here at Junk Food Cinema.
Yeah.
Because it's also the opening of...
Isn't it Rolling Thunder?
It is Rolling Thunder, yeah. Absolutely. They had originally intended that song was going to underscore the whole movie. And then they decided, well, no, that's not really going to work. So they decided they were just going to put it at the beginning. Well, apparently they shot this in Hungary, in Budapest, or at least the castle stuff they did.
And they're trying to pass it off as the Pacific Northwest,
which is like, I don't remember the Pacific Northwest looking like a goddamn fairy tale, but okay. But apparently the crew loved that song so much that every time they weren't filming, they had it blasting on the loudspeaker. So I'm like, can you imagine being on that set and hearing that song for the 38th time?
It's I think I would go insane. Yeah. Oh my God. It's
really, really depressing song. So neither that song nor the moonshot that we were talking about were meant to be the opening. Blatty had originally devised a Vietnam War sequence at the beginning in which an American soldier is carrying a wounded Vietnamese woman for miles. And as soon as he puts her down and turns away from her, she takes out a grenade and it explodes and kills him. And then it immediately cuts to... Lieutenant Benish's face splattered with blood. Benish was the character played by Robert Loggia. But what happened was they scrapped that opening because they spoke to the Hungarian Film Commission, which is a thing, and they...
Why wouldn't it be?
And the Hungarian Film Commission assured William Peter Blatty, no, we have hundreds of Vietnamese actors that live here in Hungary, so you're definitely fine to do that shot. Come to the day of doing the shoot, they send him one 19-year-old Vietnamese boy. And he's like, what happened? You told me, I need scores of...
We call this the Ben Affleck.
I know, it's like, we need scores of Vietnamese extras, and their actual advice to him, well, just put him in makeup and wigs, and nobody will notice he's not the same person over and over again. And it's just like, wow, that's super racist, Hungary, come on.
Oh, yeah, because Hungary isn't specifically known for, you know, genocide or anything like that.
Well, I'm just saying, it's a little offsides, Hungary. It's a little offsides, Hungary. That's all I'm going to say. So... Yeah, like we said, this is a film written and directed by William Peter Blatty. Now, the story of this film, and every single one of these episodes this month, we've talked about the specificity of the crazy in the movie. Now, in this film, yes, while every individual soldier has kind of his own psychological proclivities, shall we say, the movie adds the juicy ingredient of religion into this kind of month-long simmering stew of crazy that we've been working on for March Madness. And I think that's probably the most interesting thing about it is it's all of this kind of insanity is going on as sort of an overture for this really deeply thoughtful examination of faith, which is not surprising giving Blatty, but is really surprising considering how they dress it up.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, that's what works best about this film is how existential it is and how deep it goes into its Catholic roots. There's a lot of, there's an awful lot of symbolism in this movie that's Catholic symbolism. And a lot of it doesn't make any sense until you get to the ending of the movie. It really is one of those things that while you're first watching it, it just seems weird. But once you know what the movie's about and where the movie's going, all of a sudden, all this stuff kind of falls into place and you're like, oh, okay. Now that shot on the moon with Jesus on the moon totally fucking makes sense.
That moon crucifixion scene, man.
Yeah.
That moon
crucifixion It has a moon scene. Crucifixion scene. That's how fucking weird this movie is. But the moon crucifixion scene makes total fucking sense.
That's
in context. And that's what is so magnificent about this film is that it's one of those films that you watch and it seems like it's just like, oh, hey, look, it's artsy. It has meaning.
Weird
it's
for
symbolism.
Weird sake.
And then you get to the end, you're like, no, there isn't a single fucking shot in that movie that's symbolism for symbolism's sake.
No.
It really is what's going on in this character's mind and crystallizing what he's thinking about and what he's striving for.
Yeah.
And it's really, especially when you deal with it with the absolute ending, you know, the final shot of the movie, all of this stuff crystallizes into something very, very much in the vein of The Exorcist about faith.
Yeah.
And why not only should these films, you know, not only do these films exist in the same universe, they really exist in the same universe.
Absolutely.
This is a universe where the God and the devil exist.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I want to reiterate that there is not a single wasted bit of crazy in this movie. Everything that you see that seems so out of left field, that seems so odd for odd's sake, has a part to play in the final act and in the final message of the movie. There's so much going on in secret in this film that's also right in front of us. I mean, if you're looking for it, the lunacy of the film isn't just for comedy's sake. These instances are, they're like signposts on this really complicated roadmap.
Yeah.
But then once you see the destination, every step of that journey makes sense.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see the other characters and their insanities and see how they work together. There's some really messed up kind of offensive jokes in here as well. There's a blackface sequence where one of the guys is doing a whole blackface number in front of the only black inmate. And then later on, the black inmate's running around and he's wearing a superhero outfit.
Has a big N.
Well, the second superhero outfit he makes has a big N on it. And it's never addressed, but it's like, oh, geez, that's pushing buttons.
Moments before, black N-man announces boldly, I'm going to Peru, and walks away. What happens right before that? Motherfucker flies by on a jetpack.
Yes.
Just like, is Q from James Bond an inmate here? How is this working right now?
Yeah, and that sequence, you're watching that sequence, you're like, is this is this a play? Is this...
They're putting on it. There's a play within the movie that the inmates are putting on where they're trying to cast dogs in Hamlet. Like,
yeah, he writes, one of the characters is writing Shakespeare for dogs.
Yes.
And
which, by the way, I would watch every day of the week.
That is some of the better jokes in the movie, as all the Shakespeare for dog gags. I mean, those really do work.
Yeah.
Those are really kind of funny. You know, the oddest casting in this and the oddest letdown is Robert Loggia, who you're like, holy crap, it's Robert Loggia. That guy's amazing. And really, his character just kind of screams a lot.
Yes, but that tirade, that angry tirade about, what is it, anal fungus that he's like screaming at the overseer of the hospital about is such an amazing scene. And apparently, you know, someone asked William Peter Blatty, like, how did you direct Loggia in that scene? He goes, I didn't. Loggia just came in and is like, William, I kind of see this as like, he's like a big child and someone's taking his favorite toy away and he's throwing a tantrum. And William Peter Blatty's like, yeah, okay. And just let him go. Like, there was no directing of Loggia. He's just in, he is actually a madman, and he pulls it off so well. So, yes, I agree with you, he's underutilized, but the scenes that he does have are fantastic.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that about it.
But, yeah, it's a really, really interesting character piece that really just focuses on these two amazing performances with a couple of other side performances that are really great.
Yeah.
Wait, you know what? You know who we didn't mention?
Who did we not mention?
There's a young actor in this.
Oh, yes, I know.
Who has very few lines in the movie, but who is a Junk Food Cinema favorite.
If we had a Hall of Fame, this guy would be in it.
Yeah, it's odd because you see him and he looks so much like a younger version of one of the other actors that at first you're like, are they playing around with me? Are they messing with me? And then it's like, no. But it's no. I'm just keying in on him because it's Tom fucking Atkins.
It's Tom Atkins. And I want to talk about him a little bit later because I don't really think we can talk about this movie without talking about the ending. And I want to kind of save all that stuff for like a very spoilery third act.
A spoilerific third act. Yeah, no, because this is a movie that needs to be discussed. And I was actually shocked that we've gotten this far without getting into spoilers.
Yeah.
Because that is, this is a movie. In fact, I would, when we get to the spoiler section of this, I would not say turn it off, watch it fresh. Because that may not be the way to watch this. It's up to you depending on how you enjoy watching movies, because this is very much a movie that asks you to process it and is a much better film the second time around than it is the first time around once you know where it's going. And it's a film that you can really appreciate for its performances because it's more of a play than a film.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not incredibly cinematic except in these rare shots, these sequences, usually dream sequences. And the rest of the time, it is very play-like where you're in a room and you don't leave that room for 10, 15 minutes. And you're just interacting with one another. You watch these characters interact with one another without leaving, without going out, or at the most flipping the camera out and looking out into the hallway and seeing what crazy shit's going on there before turning the camera back in and continuing the scene.
Yeah.
It is really 2 hours. I would say it's an hour and a half of just these kind of performances. And then when they leave the castle in the third act, that's when it actually becomes more of a movie.
I would agree with that. And I want to talk about a couple things before we get back into spoiler territory. The first is what the actual ninth configuration is, what the title refers to. Basically, it's a philosophy laid down by a French, he was a philosopher and a chemist, I believe, named Pierre Lecomte Dunoy. The idea is that it's this theory that states that in order for life to appear spontaneously on the planet Earth, so in other words, you know, it's the opposite of creationism, the idea that life can just kind of, you know, evolution, things can just kind of spontaneously happen. Basically, for life to appear spontaneously on the Earth, there has to be a protein molecule of the configuration of 0.09. Now, I don't know what that means because I am or not smart with science, but it's not just one molecule, it's hundreds of millions of them. But given the size and mass of the planet Earth, apparently the amount of time needed to generate life spontaneously by chance and for even one of these molecules to form is 10 to the 253rd billions of years. So essentially what this theory is stating is that it's far, far easier to believe in the existence of God than in the chances of that happening randomly. Right. So it's basically what the ninth configuration is it's trying to scientifically prove the existence of God through logic and through chemistry.
Right.
It also explores kind of the ninth configuration also explores the atheistic notion of the problem of evil. It's to say that Christian doctrine can't account for the existence of evil in a universe where such an omnipotent, loving God rules from on high. Now, another tenet of Lecomte's human destiny, which is that we also get the ninth configuration from, is that if we are nothing but atoms and there's no transcendence, then what we ought to be doing is rushing blindly to serve our own ends. And if that's true, how is it that you can explain that anyone, anywhere, would give his life for somebody else? So that's kind of the philosophical basis on which Blatty is drawing. Blatty himself being a Jesuit, or as he calls it, a soft Catholic, I think is how he described himself. Like he's like, I haven't taken the sacrament in a while, but I'm kind of I'm a soft Catholic.
Yeah.
So, and again, much like with The Exorcist, this is a movie about faith and about sort of, you know, redemption and, you know, the presence of evil actually proving the existence of good. So, I mean, he's dealing with a lot of really meaty metaphorical philosophical stuff here.
Yeah, no, it is a deep as fuck movie. It's really interesting how he goes about that too. And where he ends up, and it's so interesting that who he ultimately pits against one another, at the end of the day, who is who, mm-hmm. and what their roles are in this conversation is really fucking fascinating. Because there's a lot more than meets the eye in this movie. But what I will say for those of you who don't want, heavy spoilers, as metaphysical as this movie is intellectually, it's not a metaphysical movie. It is not a movie that this is not some weird, these guys aren't in purgatory. Like the thing is there's this opening line that really hints that this might be a supernatural movie, mm-hmm. that this might be a purgatory movie, that this might have, you know, this might be something like Lost. Like you have no idea what the fuck you're getting into. Mm-hmm. And really what it is it is a drama about these guys who are very damaged trying to get their shit together and trying to see their way through the madness.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating how they go about it. And
yeah.
It's really, really unbearably good just yeah. in its concept. Although its execution is a little hit or miss.
And that's the
thing about this movie is that, you know, it's the first half an hour of this movie moves like molasses.
That's true. It's very deliberately paced, as they say.
You need to watch this movie in daylight with a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. And it's worth it. And it's absolutely worth
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And it's going to be better the second time you watch it because you'll notice, as we said, all of the things that really tie, like once you have the metaphorical, the falafels of this movie.
This movie is a very falafel movie.
Once you have the falafel principles,
you take the falafel and you rub it against your, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry,
exactly.
Bill O'Reilly joke.
Once you have the philosophical foundation of this movie, stuff really starts to make sense. Like why the character is an astronaut, why the movie opens with the moon, why there's a crucifixion scene on the moon. You may remember that Neil Armstrong quote, which wasn't really his quote, as Apollo 11 sat down on the moon, which was, we have slipped the surly bonds of Earth and touched the face of God. So it's like a very religious connection there already to the space program. And that character, Cutshaw, his fear of going to the moon is that he's going to go to a nothingless, desolate celestial body that is going to basically represent the fact that there is no God. There's nothing there.
And that he won't be able to come back and he'll die alone.
Die alone.
Up yeah. there on the moon. And he's terrified of it. And so he cracks.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, that's what I mean. Once you understand where Blatty's coming from with his philosophy, everything about this movie, every little nuanced piece starts to fit together like a puzzle. And that's why I think the second time you watch this movie is going to be far more rewarding than the first. But do not give up on that first viewing. Because once all the pieces start to come together and you see what they're doing with the narrative, with the story structure, man, is that second viewing good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. By the time the bikers show up, dude, that sequence.
That fight scene! Oh, God.
Oh, yes. No, this is a movie that, like I said, for the first hour and a half is a play. It is a play. And then we end up in a scene that is your classic 70s era prolonged bully scene.
Yes.
In which we just watch our characters get put through the ringer in what is torture porn without being full torture. Like, you just, by the end of that scene, you're just like, I fucking hate all these people. Oh my God. And then one of the characters snaps.
Oh, yeah.
Snaps in such a way that the fight scene's really only about 30 seconds long.
Yeah, it is less, literally, I timed it. It is less than a minute long.
Yeah, it is just, but it is so fucking intense.
Yeah.
And just the way it goes down, you're just like, fuck. And then once you're like, fuck, then you start cheering it on, and you're cheering on a psychopath who is tearing through and killing people. And you're just like, fuck yeah, it's about time. God damn.
Yeah. I mean, you're probably like, look, we have waxed poetic about the deep spiritual subtext of this metaphorically dense piece of cinema, but I can hear it right now. There's a whole group of you that are sitting there with your beer and your popcorn with your nacho cheese and french fries in it, and you're like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with this? I like my Lost Gems a little dirtier, a little rougher around the edges. Just watch the fight scene.
Oh,
just watch the scene. Oh.
Let's do that in the spoiler section.
Okay.
So yeah, at this point, trust us, this movie is well worth sitting through. Watch it. Watch it in your first watch in the afternoon. It's not one to save till 1 a.m. After you've worked a long day. It's not that movie. The first time I did it, that's what I did. It had been a long day, but I'm like, I love this movie. I'll sit down, and then half an hour in, and I woke up and I was like, okay, rewind, because I'd left it on. And I need a cup of coffee, and I had a cup of coffee and sat up in bed instead of laid down and watched it and powered through it and loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Well, let this also serve as your official spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. So at the end of this movie, we learn a little.
Don't forget to go back into the Corman alarm tonight.
Oh, yeah. I got to go back into the Corman alarm. This is going to be fun to edit. So at the end of the movie, we learn a little something about Stacy Keach's character, Kane. He's actually referred to as Killer Kane.
Well, the original title of the book this was based on, because here's the weird thing, is this book was written in like 66. Then he rewrote it in the 70s and released it in the ninth configuration. The first time this book was released, it was called Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane.
Which is such an amazing title, but totally gives away the ending.
Well, because it wasn't supposed to be a secret, you know, and it was he actually likes the first version of the book better because it's zanier and funnier. And then he went more existential with the second version of it.
Well, it's weird how this came about, too, because he was actually hired by Columbia in the late 70s to adapt this play. I can't remember the name of the play, but it was essentially kind of the setup of Ninth Configuration with the asylum and the wacky characters. It was a comedy. So he starts working on that, and Columbia starts demanding to see pages. And he's like, no, I'm not showing you pages. I'm still working on this. And then he walked into his office at Columbia one day. There was a new secretary, hands him a little slip of paper that just says, you're fired. So he gets fired off the project, but he decides to combine his adaptation of the play with Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane. The playwright sues him, and a judge finds that he has actually created something wholly different from the original source, that there's no grounds for plagiarism. So that is the birth of this script, is it's actually the unholy union of two very different things.
Yeah. And so Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane, the basic actual plot of this movie is that Stacy Keach is actually this guy named Colonel Killer Kane, you know, killer in quotation marks, who in Vietnam flips the fuck out and kills what people estimate to be 30 to 40 people with his bare hands, yet he says he's done more than that. There's a mix-up in the military, as is often the case, and he gets called back to report for duty as a psychiatrist at this insane asylum. Apparently, there is another Killer Kane out there.
They send for Kane. That's the important thing, is that they send for Kane. He shows up. The military, as soon as he gets there, knows it's not him.
Yeah.
Knows it's not the right Kane. They let him go with the charade, hoping that if they let him pretend he's in charge, that maybe some of his weird, violent PTSD will start to come into focus
because
for him?
The actual Kane is there, and the reason why there are two Colonel Kanes is they're brothers.
Yes.
And so the guy who claims to be the medic is actually Kane's brother, and is trying to get his brother to work through this psychotic break that he suffered that caused him to do all these horrible things, because now he has isolated Killer Kane as another individual who he believes is dead, and he believes that he's the brother.
Yeah.
So that he's Killer Kane's brother. So he's actually believing he is his own brother who we're watching as the medic.
And who's standing right in front of him and he doesn't recognize. And honestly, the champion performance in the whole movie, if you ask me, is from an actor named Ed Flanders, who plays Colonel, quote, Fell, who's actually Kane's brother.
Yeah.
When you get to the end of that movie and you see that moment where you realize who he is and what their relationship is, you understand the full breadth of how really restrained and painful that performance is. And then again, when you go back and watch it the second time and you watch this guy quietly hope against hope that what he does makes his brother remember, and that every moment he doesn't is pure torment, it's tragic. It's beautiful and tragic at the same time.
Yeah.
So I definitely think that's the unsung champion performance of this movie. Yeah. Is Ed Flanders as Colonel Fell.
So essentially what we have is this guy who's killed dozens of people with his bare hands, in terrible, awful ways. Like, he used wires to cut people's heads off, and just, like, you know, there's a scene that we see him sitting there cradling a head in his hands. I mean, it's
not his own head in his own hands, but
no, yeah,
someone else's head.
But he is trying to cure this astronaut in hopes that by curing the astronaut, he can find forgiveness. And this is what all the Christ metaphors are. Because the character that is ultimately trying to prove that there's good in the world is a guy who's had a psychotic break and killed dozens of people. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what this movie is about. This movie's about that guy who does those terrible, awful, horrible things that you hear about and become urban legends. And he's actually shut himself off and is trying to sacrifice himself in a way to show this guy that there really is good in the world, to prove that there really is a God.
Well, I mean, it's like I said before, if you're wondering what I meant by this movie seeks to not only debunk the problem of evil, which is to say that the existence of evil disproves the existence of God, and actually make the statement that in this story, at least, the existence of good is proven by someone who is evil.
Yeah.
So it's very complicated the way that Blatty goes about it, but very fascinating to watch. And I will say this, coming back to Tom Atkins for a moment, Tom Atkins is the whole key to this movie. If you watch him, he's playing like Kane's colleague who like drives it. He's his driver, you know, brings him to the hospital. He's a military guy. He's around every once in a while. His mannerisms are bizarre. Like, he's just got these weird looks on his face, and he's very in and out of rooms quite slowly. And then you realize by the end of the movie, and especially in the second viewing, he's not Kane's colleague or his subordinate. He's his fucking keeper.
He's his handler.
He's the guy warning us without us knowing it that we should be wary of Kane, and we don't even see it. I mean, I think that's why, to me, this is why the inmates are performing Hamlet throughout the film. I have a theory on this. There is a specific emphasis in that movie on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Like, they're having trouble casting dogs as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. If you're a theater geek like me, you probably remember Tom Stoppard's play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which is about two minor characters of Hamlet that are largely babbling to each other while one of the greatest stories ever told is going on all around them without their ever being involved.
And they're constantly lost in it and they have no idea what's going on.
Blatty turns us into Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah.
That's what's happening in this movie. I mean, the story, the real story is unfolding all around us, but we don't even notice that.
You know, and you know what I have totally forgotten to mention? This is one of the... I meant to mention this right up front, but I'm glad I didn't, that I saved it for the spoiler section. This movie was totally ripped off by another novelist and turned into a Scorsese film.
Are you talking about Shutter Island?
Shutter Island.
Oh, wow.
Shutter Island has the exact same twist as this movie, because they hide who Killer Kane is for the bulk of the movie, and it isn't till the third act that you find out that he's really not a psychiatrist. I mean, granted, if you've seen Shutter Island, you figure it out within the first 10 minutes. You're just like, wait, this guy is, he's a little weird. Oh, he's a patient, not the doctor.
That's, I think, one of the oldest twists in asylum movies. I mean, we, to this day, have movies where it's, you know, they're set in a mental institution and it's like, I'm the new doctor. And it's like, oh, he's actually a lunatic as well. That is one of the oldest twists. But what I think is even more interesting about this movie is what that twist represents and who the actual doctor is in relation to the guy pretending.
Yeah, no, and I think this has a much more profoundly emotional arc than Shutter Island is. I think Shutter Island is the much more invigorating movie. I think it's the better mystery. I think this movie is much better at grasping its existentialism and has the much more interesting characters and the much more interesting killer.
Yeah.
Because this very much is a statement on the war and what war does to people and what soldiers try to do to free themselves from the things that they've done at war. And everything about how this is structured and how this is written is great, which leads us to what we were talking about before. So we've got this character, the astronaut, escapes from the asylum, and we've got Killer Kane going after him. And we know he's Killer Kane. At this point in the movie,
we've figured it out.
We fucking know. They have told us. We know that this guy can kill 40 fucking armed motherfuckers is bare hand.
Yeah.
And this guy goes into a bar where a bunch of fucking bikers are, and the bikers have started picking on the astronaut.
Because they recognize him as that lunatic astronaut.
Yes. And so once someone comes and tries to get him, they decide, fuck it, we're outnumbering this guy, we're going to push him to the limit. And so what Killer Kane does in that scene is he does everything he can to save his friend without getting violent. And he
supplicates himself, which is a very Christian turn the other cheek kind of move.
Yeah.
And he tries and tries and tries to keep from fighting, and they won't have it. So finally, when he snaps and that leash comes off. Now, what follows, the unleashing of Killer Kane is a brutal, unflinching punch to the audience throat. I mean, there are male and female members of this biker gang that are meeting grisly ends at the hands of Killer Kane.
Holy shit, dude.
And again, I want to reiterate, this whole fight takes less than a minute. I timed it.
Oh yeah, but the thing is how it works and the brilliance of it. It's the very best part of the movie in every way, simply because we watch Kane go through so much, and you know who the fuck this guy is. He's forced to lick beer off the floor. He's got to admit that Marines suck. He's got to admit that Marines are cowards. He's got to say all these terrible things. They play beach ball with him, kicking him around. He does nothing. And finally, he gets to the point where he snaps, and he fucking starts killing everybody.
Yeah.
And you see the guy that was able to kill all those people come out, and it is just... And at that moment, you're so like, yeah, fuck yeah, these guys have it coming. And at the same time, there's this pit in your stomach. So you're like, fuck, dude, all that work he went through.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not ever going to be fixed. He's, this is why he was working so hard and taking all, taking that beating. And because he did not want to go back and be that guy. And when he finally does, it really is mixed emotions, which make that moment so beautiful. Because in most movies, you can't wait to watch the crazy guy bust out a can of whoop ass. And this time you're like, don't do it, dude.
Yeah.
Don't do it, dude. And then you're like, oh, no, fuck these guys. You know what? You don't need to get better. Fuck these guys in particular.
You're simultaneously rooting for him to kill everyone and to not kill everyone. And self-sacrifice, by the way, is a huge running theme throughout this movie. There's a great line in the church scene where the priest specifically says, the good shepherd gives his life for his sheep.
Yeah.
And this fight scene, like we said, it kind of feels like it undoes all of the good work that he's done.
Ultimately, after that fight, we get to the point where he actually kills himself. And when he kills himself, he makes that sacrifice. He writes a letter to the astronaut saying that I hope that what I've done is a good act. And it actually ends up saving him. And we see that the astronaut is saved. He's gone back to NASA.
Which is even that is really given to us in a very subtle way. Like when he pulls up in the car, we don't know how much time has passed.
No.
But all of a sudden we see Cutshaw, who throughout the movie, by the way, is like dangerously insane.
Yes.
Like he comes crashing into rooms. He screams about everything. Like I mean, you doubt throughout the whole film that this guy is ever going to be able to be pulled back. And then after we watch Stacy Keach's death and things kind of fade to black, we fade up again. And there's a car arriving, much like it did at the beginning of the film, except it's Cutshaw in the back. And Cutshaw is now wearing his military, his Air Force uniform. And if you look at his uniform, he's got medals, he's got a NASA pin. The license plate of the car says NASA.
Yep.
And you realize that not only has he been cured of his mental condition, but he's probably been to the moon.
Yeah, he's probably gone to the moon.
He's probably finally, you know, confronted that fear.
Yeah. And just to add icing onto the cake, you know, he goes and he wanders around. But there was a scene earlier in the movie when he's still bugfuck nuts and he still believes this guy is a killer Kane as a psychiatrist. And he says, hey, if you die before me, will you come back and prove to me if there's an afterlife? And he goes, well, I'll try. And there's this whole big thing about this St. Christopher medallion.
And there is the other connection to The Exorcist that I mentioned before. It's the exact same medal.
Yep.
That Father Karras has in The Exorcist. And actually, the story about that medal, I can understand why it's in both movies. And not only does it, I think, support the idea of a shared universe, but basically what happened is when William Peter Blatty's mother died, she was being buried with two medals. And he himself always wore one of the medals that she had. But he decided that he was going to let her be buried with the medals. The next day he wakes up, and he goes to the mirror and he hears something jingling. And he's looking around, can't figure out what it is. Around his neck is the other medal. And he's never been able to explain, it was the St. Christopher medal,
yeah,
how it fucking got there. And it profoundly changed him. And it was that moment where, very much like Father Karras' mother and how that factored into his faith, like it was one of those life-changing moments for him. And that's why it's in there. But I also like the idea that it's a shared universe.
Yeah. But so you get to the end where he goes back in the car, and the St. Christopher medal is hanging there. Mm-hmm. And his had an inscription. And he's like, how did this medal get here? And he turns it over. And you don't see the inscription. You just see the look in his face. And it's profound joy. And mm-hmm. then, you know, 70s freeze frame. Bam, we're out. Yeah. And
San Antonio's. No, they don't play it again.
Yeah. But no, it's the end of the movie is there is a God. And throughout the movie, as I said, there's this Christ iconography, and you have that scene where there's the as we mentioned, the crucifixion on the moon. And what that is Killer Kane dreaming of the sacrifice that he will do to save the astronaut.
Exactly.
And so ultimately, he is the Christ figure of this movie, while the astronaut is the lost. He's the shepherd, and you know, this is the sheep. And it is the entire movie played back through, watching it. You see that in every bit of iconography they use and when they use it, and you see that in all these wonderful scenes. The movie does a really magnificently brilliant job of driving that idea home, and it's just so fantastic.
Absolutely. And I think that St. Christopher medal then becomes a talisman. It becomes this clear signal that there is an afterlife, and that not only that, but that Kane is there. That sacrifice has meant something, and that, you know.
So between his three biggest movies, Exorcist, Ninth Configuration, and Exorcist 3, there is a devil and there is a God, and this is a universe. Mm-hmm. These three movies all exist together, and the Ninth Configuration is really William Peter Blatty's sequel in some way, shape, or form. So you can just not watch Exorcist 2, as all good junk food cinema viewers should know.
There you go. And also, I want to throw, since Cargill has supported his theory so well, I want to throw a couple more pieces of evidence into the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern connection. Like we said before, this was based on his script that he began that he started circulating around in 1966 called Twinkle Twinkle Killer Kane. That is also, incidentally, the same year of the first staging of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead. Also interesting to note that Blatty wrote his master's thesis on T.S. Eliot's criticisms of William Shakespeare. So I think two things. I think this is definitely in the same universe. This is The Exorcist 2. And that there's a very strong connection between this film and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead.
And if you have never experienced that, it's not only a good read. You can find the book quite a few places, the script of the play. Or you can watch the wonderful early 90s version of it, starring Tim Roth and Gary Oldman.
That's great.
Which is an absolutely brilliant version of that play and done as a film, and it's wonderful, has an amazing cast to it, and you should seek that out. In fact, that's something that I've kicked around us doing here on Junk Food Cinema. We haven't really done Shakespeare yet, but there's a number of Shakespearean things I'd like to do at some point, and that's
it's
one
really
of them.
Hard to sell Shakespeare's junk food, but maybe with that movie we can,
you know, there are a couple of crazy fucking stagings of Shakespeare, that Shakespearean stories. I think we could get away with Titus as a junk food cinema.
If you're playing the drinking game at home, go ahead and take a drink, since we're talking about future shows in the middle of our current show.
That is correct.
But I do want to talk a little bit about the production of this movie, because in a lot of ways, the production of the film and what happened afterwards is every bit as crazy as the inmates in the film itself. This new Blu-ray that we've been watching is one of actually five versions of the Ninth Configuration. So you're probably thinking to yourself, the studio or maybe some vindictive producer is clearly to blame for all these versions. It's not necessarily true. It's true of one version, but Blatty edited or did the cuts of all the other versions. So when they say director's cut, he cut four different versions of this film.
Is this the director's cut that we watched?
It is the most complete cut, for sure. And so the first version, Blatty actually, like I said, pulled away from Warner Brothers because they cut a radio spot that tried to make it sound like The Exorcist. Then it went to United Film Distributors. They take it on. He recuts it for them. He makes it 10 minutes shorter. But then this is really interesting. Blatty wanted to release it in one theater, just one, and he wanted to see what word of mouth would do. And they told him, oh, yeah, that's totally what we're going to do. And then he released it in several theaters behind his back because they were like, fuck, that's a terrible idea. So he took it from them. So then it gets in the hands of New World, which you may remember is run by Roger Corman, of course. But you might have a hard time believing this. Roger Corman did something shady.
What?
I know.
What?
What?
What? Yeah!
That was fun. He recut the film without Blatty's knowledge or permission, so he yanked it from New World. Now, the fourth version of this film is probably the most fascinating. The ending shot is different, because the ending shot of this film, we see Stacy Keach after the bar fight. He's sitting in a room with Cutshaw, and he's wearing a blanket. And it's clear that he's dying. And then as Cutshaw leaves the room, his hand slides down on the blanket, and there's a knife that falls to the floor. It was the biker's knife, and you realize he's killed himself. Now, Keach and the studio were both very nervous about the idea of a suicide at the end of the movie. So what Keach suggested is, let's just shoot it again, but this time we don't show the knife. So the implication becomes not that he had killed himself, but that the biker had stabbed him and that he was dying of his wound. And that version, Blatty basically shot just to appease Keach and was like, it's be for safety, we'll never use it. But then that version with that ending got released theatrically as well. And then the fifth version, which is the one on this Blu-ray, restores the knife and actually has, speaking of ADR, Keach had to come back shortly after they shot it and re-narrate the letter, because the letter originally had no mention of suicide, because it was the Keach cut, as we'll call it. So, right off the bat, there's five different versions of the movie. Blatty appears in the movie as a character named Frome, and he had to play that part, because they had to reshuffle the cast around, because days before they were going to start shooting, their two leads, Michael Moriarty and Nicole Williamson, left the project.
Okay, so, last year,
I gave you my heart.
The very next day, you gave it away. True. No, last year we talked about a film called Harlequin, which is one of those really great cerebral, surreal films that, mm-hmm. If you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to that episode, because I do love the shit out of that movie. But if you remember that episode, you'll remember that weeks before that was shot, its two primaries backed out.
Yeah.
And they were David Bowie and Orson Welles. And
oh, that's right, yeah.
And you watch this movie going, oh my God, if only they'd gotten that, everyone would know this movie. And then you watch The Ninth Configuration and you realize that Michael Moriarty and someone else were supposed to star in this movie, and you're like, oh, thank God they got Stacy Keach and Scott Wilson at the end, because they're what makes this movie watchable.
Not only that, they got those guys fast. They lost the actors on Friday. By Tuesday, Stacy Keach and Scott Wilson were already in Budapest.
Yeah. And man, dude, seriously, those.
I can't imagine that film.
This movie with Michael Moriarty? Are you fucking kidding me?
Michael Moriarty is fun, but he is not. He's just not a good enough actor to pull off this role.
Oh, no. This role in particular, I just don't think it would have worked. Stacey Keach lends so much heart to this.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with Scott Wilson. That's the thing about Scott Wilson. Scott Wilson's really. He's one of those great character actors who you're always rooting for, even when he's on the other side of your protagonist. Mm-hmm. You always feel for the guy, and he brings that in spades here. Like, seriously, I think this is the single greatest performance for both of those actors. It's sad that it's not the performances that they are remembered for or are going to be remembered for. It is, if you like either or both of these actors, you must watch this movie, because this is 2 hours of them being fucking amazing.
So, and the other thing is, you may remember the waitress in the bar scene who calls the asylum to get Kane to come and save Cutshaw. That was Linda Blatty at the time. That was her name. She was William Peter Blatty's wife. She left him for his executive producer on this film. So in the course of making this movie, yeah. And if you thought that was the weirdest thing, oh no. You know who financed this movie? Pepsi. PepsiCo financed this movie. Apparently, they had put a bunch of money into this bottling plant in Budapest that they were trying to get out. The funds were basically being held. And the deal that was made was that the film commission, again, the wonderful upstanding Hungarian film commission, says, you know, if they shot more American movies here, our tourism rates would go up. So we want you to get a movie to shoot out here. And Pepsi went, we're a fucking soft drink company. Like, I don't know if that
works. You know what our American slogan is, right? Is Pepsi's he okay? That's our whole slogan. Yeah, that's what we
Pepsi,
do.
Is Pepsi okay? Yeah, I guess. Is this movie going to work? Who knows? But Pepsi was like, well, we want that money. So, okay, we'll make this movie as long as there is almost no product placement in it, except for the one scene in the asylum where we clearly see a Pepsi machine. But, like, what kind of flea market, schoolyard, double plus bad bargain is that? Like, it's you get a soda company. You're the nation of Hungary, and you get a soda company to make a movie. You give them a shit ton of money thinking that it's going to save your tourism. That story, like, that sentence is maybe the weirdest part of this whole movie.
And yet, that's the reason this movie exists, though. As crazy as that is, Blatty actually was taking a version of this script around before The Exorcist. He was trying to get this made, and no studio wanted to make it. And it was Friedkin who read it, because he wanted Friedkin to do it. And they wanted to work together on it, and then they decided to go ahead and work on this other thing together. The Exorcist.
This other little thing you might have heard of.
So this movie is actually directly responsible for The Exorcist happening, and this movie exists as well it fucking should because of this weird tangle of bullshit between Pepsi and Hungary.
Which brings us beautifully to the junk food pairing this week.
Excellent.
This movie is literally brought to you by Pepsi. Blatty is, as he puts it, a relaxed Catholic, and we've talked about the iconography in this movie of talismans, as represented once again by the St. Christopher medal, as was in The Exorcist. The Ninth Configuration also delves deeply into the problem of good, the problem of evil, God, the devil, their coexistence, the two sides at odds, always in flux, possibly representative of two sides of the same argument, the yin and the yang, you might say. So if you look at the Pepsi logo...
So this week the junk food pairing is my yang?
No, it's Pepsi, goddammit. And if you look at the Pepsi logo, you might think to yourself, this soda magnate is actually a fitting sponsor for this film. It is not, however, sponsored this episode, so we won't say their name. Sorry, Pepsi, but we're not saying Pepsi.
Are we bleeping? Are we bleeping that?
No, I forgot to do that. Okay. Sorry about that.
That man is a lunatic and dangerous.
Well, thanks for joining us on this, the last episode of March Madness here at Junk Food Cinema. We hope you will track down Ninth Configuration and give it a shot, and then give it another shot, because I'm telling you, that second viewing is going to be so sweet. Sweeter than a can of that company that we only mentioned 10 times without getting any money from. But yeah, once again, you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me at facebook.com/massaworm.
That's you, yeah.
That's me. And you can find me on Twitter at massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find my Facebook page at Facebook. facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic, or you can check me out at my home away from home, oneofus.net. Lots of great geek podcasts and blogs over there. So, yeah, I guess we'll just go ahead and sign off. I thought I would come up with a crazy ending for this episode to really cap off the month, but
I don't know for a fact. I don't say. That's the kind of hairpin I am.